discussing national and international issues. You're listening to Pella Neuroth-Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome to the Pella Neuroth-Taylor Show on this Tuesday afternoon. I was just watching that news clip with Sunak talking about Rwanda as the destination of asylum seekers, and not much analysis behind it. But I advise you to go back into the archives of my show, because I've followed this Rwanda story quite closely. And Michaela Wrong and Alan Stamm both have made very interesting contributions on the reality of the regime that runs the country since 1994 and been very close to Britain. Michaela Wrong wakes up in a cold sweat at night, this very experienced Africa hand, former FT correspondent, and has had her life threatened, and is generally very wary of that regime. And maybe we'll have some more guests on to tell us about the truth about Kagame, Paul Kagame. Anyway, well, we've got a packed show for you today. We've got the usual bandwidth-hogging topics of Ukraine and the Middle East, and they'll get their due. Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, has talked about the dangerous behavior of certain nuclear powers, and I think he mentioned the French. He doesn't often talk in such extreme terms. And I just want to say that what's overhanging this is two rumors on Twitter, and they may just be rumors. I just say that. I was talking to yesterday to Basil about this rumor that the Israelis incredibly sent some F-35 into the air with a sort of nuclear bomb in which they were going to detonate over the skies of Tehran and cause an electromagnetic pulse, close down of electronic facilities. Now, that seems incredible. And he's got a lot of pushback, the guy who said it. But the guy who said it is one of the alt-media sphere's best-known and best-regarded journalists, Pepe Escobar. And he's doubled down this morning after enormous pushback from his supporters and Twitter followers. And that's a good thing. If you've got pushback from your... if you've got followers who give you pushback, that means there's a healthy intellectual community. And they're very doubtful, and I have to say I'm doubtful, but he said he's going to provide some kind of evidence for it. He's got two solid sources. He's going to look for a third. So we'll see. I think, even though it's true, though, I have to say, I don't know if it's a very responsible thing to go on about, because obviously there are reasons why things are secret. I'm for truth, but sometimes you have to use discretion as well, especially if truth can set off more escalations. I don't know. Anyway, having said that, I've just talked about it, so I'm being hypocritical there. The second thing is there's a guy called Larry Johnson, who's a well-known former CIA agent, also well-regarded, and he claims to have footage of French troops in Odessa after all that talk by Macron. But again, there's a lot of pushback on that, and probably it could well be psyops for some reason or other, especially the F-35 story. The Israelis are creating tension in the Middle East. That said, there was a New York Times article, very long one, talking about precisely how much the Biden administration worked bloody hard to stop the Israelis from doing, if not an F-35 attack with EMP and all that. Nevertheless, quite a strong attack on Tehran and the facilities around it. And we should be very grateful that the trio of Blinken, Sullivan, and Biden did manage to use their allies and friends, maybe even Britain, to pull back Netanyahu. But obviously the climate there is still very tense. We've got a couple of British correspondents in Russia to bring us through to the first, second hour, Danny Armstrong and Johnny Miller. They both know the pulse of what's going on in Moscow. And then in the second hour, we're just going to pivot away a little bit from the Middle East and Ukraine into another topic, which is the American Constitution needs to be revitalized. America needs to take a new look at itself. And this new nationalism, which emanating from Trump, has to be sort of burnished with sort of constitution. Talk of a new constitutional, going back to the original founding fathers, and look at how we can have a constitution that's fit for the 21st century American. Barry Hinckley calls for a redeclaration of the principles of independence, and he's pushing that, and I think we're going to give him time to develop that thought. And finally, we have got a Swedish journalist, Ingrid Carlqvist, who's going to talk us through the upcoming Eurovision Song Contest and the battle that's going to take place, at least a battle of words. Let's hope it stays there, between Muslims and Jews, or pro-Israelis and pro-Arabs, because Malmo, of course, which is where I spent much of my youth, is one of is Northern Europe's Marseille, And Israel is controversially have a Eurovision Song Contest presence there. Same time as we've got ABBA opening a museum there. So I managed to get ABBA in, always a crowd pleaser. But what I'm hoping to talk to some of the guests also sort of threaded through the afternoon is this failure of Trump to stand up to the money going to Ukraine. Is he just a deep stater like the rest of them? Some people are very disappointed there. Who was putting a gun to Trump's head, or is he just like the rest of him? Because he had a lot of neocons in his first administration, and maybe he's just words and no talk when he talks about defunding Ukraine and bringing peace. Anyway, we're going to go into our first news analysis with Basil Valentine, our political editor, and we will bring him on just after a quick break. This is the Pelinero's Taylor Show on TNT.
Getting straight to the facts.
Enough with the lies. We need facts.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelinero's Taylor Show. Good afternoon, Basil Valentine. How are you?
Good afternoon, Pelle, and hello to our viewers and listeners all around the world. Yes, first, I'd just like to correct you very quickly about what may or may not happen in Malmo in a couple of weeks' time around the Eurovision Song Contest. There will doubtless be huge demonstrations outside it at the participation of the Israeli contestant, but I would venture to suggest that that will be not just the Muslims, but all anti-genocide protesters, which may well include a large portion of what's left of the Jewish community in Malmo, as well as the native Swedes, if there are any of them in Malmo too, Pelle, these days.
Well, exactly. And we certainly can't talk about a Jewish presence there, as they're all gone, you know. I mean, it's like 50 or 100 left, a besieged community. But sure, I mean, I think that the Swedish population is quite pro-Palestinian. Sweden famously recognized Palestine back in 2014. So there'll be a lot of support, and rightly, you know.
Yeah, so again, sorry to correct you for a second time, but yes, pro-Palestinian. Doubtless there will be lots of Palestinian flags in evidence at the demonstrations. But like the protests sweeping across North American campuses, these are primarily anti-genocide protests. A lot of people there take no side. They would not necessarily be supporters of Palestine, let alone Hamas. They just want to see an end to the indiscriminate slaughter of innocents, including lots of women and children. I really do think it's important to make that point.
I think you're right, yes. On the other hand, Basil, you're not usually a stickler for words in that way, but you got the gist of what I was trying to say. But anyway,
I do enjoy a bit of pedantry from time to time. We'll come back to the protests in the United States in the second hour. I mean, really extraordinary scenes at Columbia, New York University, Yale, Harvard, now at the University of Michigan as well, with encamped protesters supported by faculty, I should add, now being arrested en masse in some cases. But in this hour, I want to look first at an extraordinary story, soiled nappies and karate kicks. What on earth is this? It's an AI-rendered Vladimir Putin biopic set to be released by the Polish studio AIO. The film, entitled simply Putin, is going to be released in 35 countries and describes itself as up close and personal with the Kremlin leader's story. Except, of course, that Putin does not appear in it himself. His part is played by an AI version of him. Absolutely extraordinary stuff. We hope that this film doesn't have political consequences, but it includes him being depicted wearing nappies. I don't know whether that is a requirement of his current, you know, state of his bodily functions or something. In a statement, the director said that he created his own AI technology to create the film version of Putin. Inviting Putin to the studio for 20,000 shots wasn't an option, and the archival materials available online didn't allow for training a high-resolution deepfake model suitable for cinematic use. As a result, after nearly 2 years of development, we've created our pioneering AI-driven technology, enabling us to craft the cinematic character without relying on a real human model. Where does this leave us going forward, Pelle?
I've got a gripe because my mother's a cartoon, a political cartoonist, but she, well, that's one of her things. I mean, not that well known, I should say, but she always says that cartoonists tell the truth, artists tell the truth. And I always say, well, it's the scientists who tell the truth because they have the brains and the analytical capabilities. And often artists just jump on the bandwagon. They're often a little bit politically naive and they know. In Sweden, a lot of the artistic community always boxed in with what the mainstream media say. I mean, they very seldom take risks. And you've got sort of a handful of people who kind of go with the alternative media version of the world, which I think is a more accurate one. And so although artists have a sort of kudos that, let's say, boring analytical people don't have, anyone who really knows how the world works is not going to be impressed by Putin in nappies. Or knowing that there have been 500 articles about him having cancer on the front page of the Swedish newspapers and ditto the Polish ones. So I always make a point, if you're going to be artistically, we're artists, you and me, Basil, because we truly go against the grain, whereas the ones that are going with the grain are the ones that are going to be forgotten. You know, don't forget, the Impressionists were refused all access to the salons of art in Paris in the 1860s and 70s. And we remember them, but we don't remember the official artists. We remember Mozart, but we don't remember Salieri. So, you know, we're an artist who made a sensitive portrayal of a man from the back streets of St. Petersburg and found himself humiliated, but without sort of being going into sort of, what's the word, hagiography, but a balanced picture. I mean, Putin needs a Tolstoy or a Chekhov or someone, you know, to give the good and the bad sides rather than sort of caricatural pie throwing contest, you know. It's as bad as worshipping him. He's the world's most interesting and maybe most powerful person, and he deserves a serious movie about him. Anyway, end of rant.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, I'm not sure exactly what the take is going to be on him. The director is famous for Polish gangster films, including Pitbull, Mafia Women, and Botox, which depict grisly violence with glossy production values, according to The Guardian. This film is apparently not just a film. The director says it's a response to a global quest to understand the motives and actions of one of the most controversial figures in contemporary politics. My production's mission is to provide viewers with a user manual for Putin, aiming to alleviate the fear and uncertainty that dominates today's world. So, you know, let's not prejudge the angle.
So maybe it is a fair portrait of him, yeah, maybe.
Yeah, let's not prejudge the angle he's going to take. But I'm concerned about how other figures, historic and contemporary, can now be recreated by this AI technology to depict them in ways that they would never have behaved.
That's right.
You know,
that's right.
And then 200 years in the future, people could find this film and think that it is actually Vladimir Putin.
And we're already there. I mean, we've already got almost every political historical story I've looked into. The mainstream view is not true. And most people who don't read a lot of history, as I do, have some a version of history that's based on some Hollywood version of something. And so this Hollywoodization of our understanding is just going to accelerate, isn't it? And, when you saw a real face of a person, you thought, well, that's good to go. That's reality somehow. If he said it, he opened his mouth and he uttered those words. That counts for something. And that's used as something for us journalists to take to the bank, you know. And when we want to show proof for where our claims come from, we use people's verbal quotes. But we can't rely on that anymore because people won't trust us that we haven't messed up or created some kind of AI quote to back up our fallacious argumentation. So everything is going to be seen as propaganda. And this is going to happen in about 5 years' time, isn't it? Or sooner.
I'm afraid you're right. I've no idea what the official Russian reaction to this is going to be. You know, let's just hope that it's a sensible film at the very least. One other quick story before we go. A Belgian man whose body makes its own alcohol has been cleared of drunk driving. A court in Bruges heard how the defendant has a condition called auto-brewery syndrome. It isn't April the 1st, Pelle, and this is sometimes brought on by intestinal problems.
Well, I guess Belgium being one of the biggest beer-drinking nations of the world, if he had to come from one country, I guess it would have to be Belgium. Was it Stella? He's married to a woman called Stella or something. Stella Artois. Anyway.
I can think of quite a few people I know who would be delighted to have auto-brewery syndrome.
The most benign. Exactly.
Yes.
Anyway, well, that raises a smile. Okay. Yes. Basil, we'll talk to you in the next hour then. We're going to go into our first guest now. This is the Pelle Neroth-Taylor Show on TNT News Talk on this Tuesday afternoon.
TNT's Jason Burmis.
Now, whether you like Donald Trump or you think he's literally Hitler, have we ever been in a situation where a person who has led this country could not take a day off from what is obviously a show trial in every respect, way, shape, and form to go see their kid graduate high school? Oh, Jason, he's a billionaire. He doesn't care. That's his like fifth kid. Who cares? How dare you, Jason? He's already got Don Jr. and Eric. He got to go to those. Look, the bottom line is this is grotesque on every level, and it shows how lawfare is being waged against anyone who goes against the narrative, even the President of the United States. And this is very dangerous.
Jason Burmis on today's News Talk, TNT.
In a democracy, the majority vote rules. But in most democracies, you can only vote for change every 3 or 4 years. To understand what people want, governments and political parties use focus groups. These focus groups can include as little as 20 people. Australia is a country of over 25 million people. Does making decisions based on 20 people sound fair to you? Have your say. Be heard in between elections. Download the For My Say app now. That is number 4, My Say.
Today's News Talk Radio.
Come on, let the man talk.
We never censor our hosts.
Good. Now, talk.
Uncensored news.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth-Taylor Show on this Tuesday afternoon. We've got Danny Armstrong with us, who's a returning guest. He's been with us before. He's a political commentator on Russian and Ukrainian politics, having spent years living in Russia and being a reporter there. Welcome to the show, Danny. Good to have you back.
Yeah, good to see you again, Pelle. Thanks for having me on.
I don't know. I want to pass by because you write with the nose to the grindstone and you've got sources and ideas. And you know things, you speak Russian and so on. This big story in the Twitter sphere, which a lot of people are giving pushback on, but this guy called Pepe Escobar, he knows Russia really well. And he's got his own Asia Times, really well known. He says that the Israelis sent a plane towards Tehran with a nuke to create a sort of electromagnetic pulse and, frazzle the Iranian grid. And then he said that the Russians took down this plane before it could do any harm. Now, it sounds unbelievable. I mean, because where would they use a nuke? You know, would the nuke big enough to fit in the bomb bay? Where are the, you know, what's happened? Where we haven't seen a lot of fuss about it, or hubbub, patrols picking these things up, a huge silence surrounding it. And but we do know that the Israelis did want a bigger attack, and there has been speculation in the Israeli media before this thing. I saw an article in an English-speaking thing, saying that this EMP attack to strike out an electrical grid is something the Israelis have thought about. Now, I was wondering, and Pepe Escobar says, well, I'm going to provide you with the final proof. he's got two intel sources. He says, I've been 30 years in Russia and the Middle East, and these two are a solid source. I'm going to give you a third one very soon. So the whole world, Twitter world, is on tenterhooks about this. I think I'm very doubtful, but, you know, he also has his credibility on the line. Have you heard anything your end?
Oh, these kind of headlines are fantastic, painting Russia out as the all-seeing, all-doing, all-singing, all-dancing nation that's able to get its tentacles absolutely everywhere and stop nuclear missiles and stop drones and repel attacks and covertly carry out the most complicated operations and mastermind attacks anywhere in the world. Because then, of course, you can blame them for anything. You can make out that they are capable of and they can be responsible for absolutely anything. We only have to look Nord Stream and the sabotage that was carried out on the Nord Stream pipeline to provide a little bit of proof and a little bit of foundation to that story, because it's great once you get the public believing that Russia can do anything and basically click its fingers and anywhere and any point in the world they can bring down the most advanced military weaponry or the most advanced military intel. Then, of course, and then you can blame them for any attack that you wish to perpetrate. And that would be very, very handy for the US. It'd be very, very handy for anybody who wants to use it that way. So I would take it with a little bit of a pinch of salt. I mean, it's worth waiting to see how this story develops, of course, but I would take it with a little bit of a pinch of salt because it's useful on both sides to say that Russia can do anything. And then it's also useful on the other side to say that Russia can, you know, they can be blamed for anything, absolutely anything that happens.
Yeah, well, it's good. We'll see how that story develops. We've also seen there's a guy called Larry Johnson. You may know about him. He runs this website called Sonar 21. He's all on the, you know, Judge Napolitano show all the time and on the Duran and so on. And he says he's shared out a video of what is alleged to be French troops in Odessa. And I haven't seen anything on the French Twitter about this. And Larry Johnson's commenters have said, you've been pepe'd, Pepe being a new meme, as in you've been taken in by intel agency propaganda. What's your take on that? Have you heard anything your end?
Well, no, I mean, the Pepe meme, I mean, it goes back for as long as I think the internet has been alive. These stories, of course, about troops being on the ground, troops from all corners. Of course, we know what we do know about troops fighting in Ukraine is that Ukraine are now facing a huge, huge depleted numbers right across the board. They have a shortage of soldiers. I wouldn't be surprised if there were troops being parachuted in quite literally from some of the NATO countries. What we are seeing now, especially on the battlefield, is Ukraine have been depleted so much that they're calling out pretty much for anybody to be joining their ranks. What it was before, where we saw huge support from NATO countries and the EU and of course America, and huge financial aid. What we're seeing now is those bodies on the ground or those feet on the ground. They're just not there anymore. Whether it be from the conflict or whether it be from wave after wave of attack from the Ukrainian side. But it wouldn't surprise me to see troops that are supporting Ukraine being in Russia. Although US troops have, of course, we know they've been outlawed from setting foot in the battlefield. And that's something that, of course, we can't see unless the US wants to be drawn into direct active battle with Russia, which I don't think that'll be a probability.
I mean, I think, some people dismiss anything that the Russians say, and obviously I don't. But I have to say, I mean, Shoigu talks about thousands of Poles and Westerners dying, and a 50% casualty rate. And like in World War One, which is a savage war, 12% of people in the trenches died, you know. So 50% is very high. But I mean, I think surely we'd have, if all these people had died, like 2,000 Poles and 1,000 Brits, surely we'd know. I mean, I know that the Western media cover up for a lot, but I mean, if you saw these body bags coming back of mercenaries, you hear about one there, two there, maybe five in all in the UK media, maybe 10. There's a huge disparity. So do you think Shoigu's telling a little bit of propaganda there?
Well, of course. I mean, the main narrative that the Russian government lead with is the fact that this conflict will, they don't want it to be fought down to the last Ukrainian, which is something that Ukraine kind of proudly, there was their war cry, if you would, we will fight down to the last Ukrainian. Of course, what that means is if it goes in the way that a lot of people think it will go, a direct conflict between Ukraine and Russia without the involvement of any other troops or without the involvement direct involvement of NATO or the US, Russia would win a war with Ukraine, and it would go down to the last Ukrainian. We're talking about generations and generations of Ukrainians being wiped out. This conflict is going on at a rate now where it's eating up a lot of funds, it's eating up a lot of, unfortunately, a lot of lives. And Shoigu is, for my money, is just echoing that sentiment that Russia has always said against the some things that Zelensky has said and that Ukraine has stuck by. We will not fight down to the last Ukraine, and that's not something that Russia wants.
Danny, we're just going to a quick news break and we'll have you back. We'll carry on talking about this idea that what both Russia and Ukraine have bad demographics, and everyone knows this, the Russians know it, and of course the West is seeing to that these demographics are being wound down or going down. Anyway, this is the Pele Neroth Taylor Show. We've got Danny Armstrong with us from Moscow talking to us about the latest and hottest news from the Russian capital. This is the Pele Neroth Taylor Show, back after the quick news break.
I got a news flash for you.
TNT Radio News.
Matt Boylan with your TNT headlines. Australia's Prime Minister's lashed out at ex-boss Elon Musk as the billionaire goes into battle to protect free speech.
I just find it extraordinary that this bloke thinks he's above the law.
The UK will start detaining migrants within days after plans to send them to Africa was approved by Parliament.
No ifs, no buts. These flights are going to Rwanda.
And 10 people have been killed in a horror mid-air collision involving two military helicopters in Malaysia.
I was such a young age. Everything changed. My name is Chloe. When I was 13, my dad was diagnosed with cancer. When I found out, I just didn't know how to react. I felt like everything was just kind of closing in on me. It just became a routine. Dad's doing chemo. I'd come home from school, wait for mum to finish work, and we'd go straight to the hospital, spend a few hours there, just draw. It was hard to navigate going to school, hundreds of kids, and I was the only one with a dying dad. He was diagnosed in March, and then he died in October. Towards the end, I heard about canteen. It kind of felt nice to know that they had other people like me. They understood what I was going through, and we didn't even have to chat about cancer. In 2020, I became a youth ambassador, so I can help others the way they helped me. I've done so many things since I was 13. I've graduated high school, university, gotten my license, made a move across the country. Life now is just a whole lot more fun. Please give a gift today to support more young people like me experiencing cancer.
Why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all major social platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time right here on today's News Talk. TNT Radio. TNT Radio.
Welcome back. We've got Danny Armstrong with us from Moscow, a British journalist of long experience of Russian, Ukrainian, and Middle Eastern politics. And we've been talking about the demographics. Danny, I can't understand this. I mean, Ukraine has lost 20% of its territory, which was pro-Russian anyway. It doesn't want to have anything to do with the Ukrainians. And now they're giving out, what are they doing? They're doubling down. There's no talk of peace. They're not going to win it back. Russia has 15, their army is bigger than it was before 2022, and they've got 10-1 shell advantage. Even I think Zelensky admits that. Now they're lowering the conscription age from 27 to 25. They're refusing to renew passports abroad. So Ukrainian young men, in Europe, in Sweden and Germany, they're going to have to go back to the slaughterhouse. The average age a year ago of the people fighting in Ukraine was like 43 or 44, these middle-aged men. You can see them doing cookouts and stuff in the trenches, family men. And now they're going to bring on the youngest generation. What's the point of all this? I mean, Ukraine is going to be slaughtered. They're not going to have any young men left. What do you say?
Yeah, I mean, this is exactly the thing. This is something that's been argued by the Russian side for quite a long time, for as long as the conflict has been going on. The original announcement from Vladimir Putin was an announcement or a message to the Ukrainian people. He said, we don't want to hurt you. This is against the Kiev regime, as they said, this special military operation. And this is why we're launching it into Ukraine to denazify, as they put it, this Kiev regime. This is not something they want to wage against the Ukrainian people, which you see as a brotherly nation and a brotherly peoples. The actual name Ukraine comes from those by the side of Russia. That's what it means in Russian. So they see themselves as one, as it were, as one nation, as one people. This is not something that Russians take lightly. And it's not something that they want to see. They don't want to see this battle go down to the last Ukrainian. They don't want to see generations of young Ukrainians wiped out just for this this conflict with this, which they see as instigated and carried out and supported by Western collusion. The two main things I would just add about the Ukrainian narrative on their side, Zelensky has repeated time and again that they will not stop and they will not come to any agreement until every piece of territory, Ukrainian territory, is under Ukrainian control. And that means the two republics, the Luhansk and Donetsk republics, and Crimea, and every single piece of territory that has been lost during the conflict. Now, of course, they're not going to get those territories back. So that means fighting and fighting endlessly, in theory, until what? If their end game is everybody understands that it's not going to be won back and that Russia doesn't want to fight down to the last Ukrainian, the last one Ukrainian, then where does it leave? I mean, what is the end game? Is it when money runs out? Is it when the support runs out? Is it when favor changes? I mean, we don't know, but those kind of narratives are dangerous, and that's why we're seeing the conscription levels going down, because they need more men in. They have depleted lines on the front line, on the battlefield, and I expect it only to get worse if this narrative is carried on.
Do you think Russia is going to get a military victory now? We've had some, I'm not a battlefield expert, but you sort of see the headlines about making advances and cracking, because that could end a war, you know, maybe. Do you think, what's your picture of that?
I'm not sure a military victory was ever I wouldn't say it was ever a main objective of what is happening and what has gone on in Ukraine. Russia has many times said that they want to sit down around the negotiating table and to bloodlessly, obviously it's too late for that to be completely and exclusively true, but to sit down and to negotiate and to talk this out and to say we would like to protect the people in the Luhansk and Donetsk People's Republics, and thrash out some sort of deal that would see an end to that sort of talk of fighting down to the sort of the last Ukrainian and to the point where all the territory that has been claimed by Russia is claimed back by Ukraine, because it leads to a stalemate. But this is a special military operation, and there were objectives lined out at the beginning. Those objectives have changed, and they're quite vague also. And so that means that Russia is in rather, I would say not an advantageous position, but certainly more favorable position to say that, look, well, we've gained our objectives, and this is something that they can say to the Russian people: we have gained our objectives. We've kept Russia safe. We've repelled NATO and Western powers from the border. We're looking to wind this up now, and we're looking to bring an end to it. So that is a huge advantage for Russia and the position that they're in now.
Well, that's the feeling I get, that the Russians don't care to make that many more advances. I don't think even, and I think you were the one that you agreed with me, and I've been more dovish on the Russian perspective than most people, but I think that could be just big talk. You know, you make a large negotiation claim and then you settle for less, and you've given me what I think is an honest assessment, which is that the Russians be happy. I mean, the thing is, what I just don't understand Ukrainian logic. They say we're going to win our country back, but people matter more than country. Why do you want to win back a people who don't want to be with you? That's the Russians, who were oppressed by the Ukrainians, and kill Ukrainians to do it. Singapore is rich without having any territory. What is this obsession with territory. You know, why can't they keep the 80% of the country, trade with the Donbass people if that's what they want, if they're so keen on their products, and everyone's happy? I just don't understand it. Of course, people are not rational, and there are greater forces at play. Anyway, we're going to wind up there. Danny Armstrong, who is a correspondent in Russia and is very, very astute and interesting. You can follow him. What's your Twitter feed, or where can we read your comments on Russian politics?
Sure, it's at Danny W. Armstrong. I'll leave you to guess what the W stands for. So.
Okay, all right. Think about that till next time. Thanks a lot, Danny. Have a good afternoon, and see you soon. This is the Pele Neroth Taylor Show on TNT News Talk. We're back after the break with another person in Russia of British origin. Thanks a lot.
Our beautiful world is changing, withering, dying by the hands of those who don't value nature, even though we all depend on it for life itself. But there is hope. Together with caring friends, the Nature Conservancy can restore our lands, heal our waters, and save our wildlife with big solutions only nature can provide. But every day we lose more of the places we love, and we urgently need to save endangered lands, waters, and wild species. The actions we take today will determine the tomorrow we leave to our children and grandchildren. The water they drink, the air they breathe, the beauty they experience. To learn more about how you can help protect and conserve our beautiful world, visit nature.org today.
One scorching heat wave will leave me powerless to cool my insulin.
When the storm rolls in, my time to find a pet-friendly evacuation center will have run out.
I'm relying on luck, but who knows if it'll be on my side.
When it comes to disasters and emergencies, it's not a matter of if, but when. Take control. 1. Assess your needs. 2. Make a plan. 3. Engage your support network. Let's prepare so we all have a better story to tell.
Exposing the deep state and government overreach. You're with Pella Nuroff-Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pella Nuroff-Taylor Show. We've got Johnny Miller, who's another British journo based in Moscow, and who spent much of the war in the Donbass, so he's not a fighting keyboardist as so many journalists are. He's seen war up close, and he's seen his friends die. Most recently, Russell Bentley, whom he'll talk a little bit about what happened there and who he was. And we'll also talk about some of the propaganda that's been coming his way, because that's, again, many people play it safe. They go with the trends and go with the flow, and they write their opinion pieces for large newspapers without suffering with almost deranged attacks I see coming from the Ukrainian side. Anyway, Johnny, you were down in Donbass, and you witnessed a lot of interesting things. And you got to know this guy called Russell Bentley, and he sadly died recently. What happened to him?
Well, I don't know what happened to him. I mean, Russell Bentley was a very well-known figure in Donbass, American, Texan, larger-than-life character who went to Donbass to fight for the Donbass militia, a communist, a very colorful character. And basically, he would take any old journalists who'd go to Donbass and Donetsk, more alternative journalists, he'd always take them around in his car around the Petrovsky district of Donetsk, which is one of the most dangerous areas. You get there, let me tell you, most people listening to this would get to that area and just want to leave. I mean, I was there with one journalist who was just scared and terrified, and I'm not criticizing him, it's terrifying. Constant incoming, that the front line is right there, and people are just walking about. You know, it's strange, so crazy to see that the front line areas of Donetsk, people are still living there, and you think, how are you still living there? It's terrifying. So you would take people around there. I don't know what happened to him. I mean, he was a volatile guy. And to be honest with you, I don't know what happened. I suspect it has nothing to do with Russia, Ukraine. I suspect it has to do with volatile characters, a lot of drink, a lot of PTSD, and that kind of stuff. That was my gut feeling when I heard about it. But sad to hear that, to hear it. But he thought he was going to die when he joined the Donbass militia. He's 65 years old, and I was very sad that only a few nights ago, and I thought about it all evening, and it was very sad. But he lived an exciting life, and he was a very larger than life character.
Are there a lot of Westerners in Donbass? Did you meet any other colorful characters?
Donbass, there's almost no Westerners. Donbass is kind of like a provincial. I mean, Donetsk city is a very beautiful city, beautiful drama city. So it's a very beautiful city. But no, there's only, apart from the odd alternative Western journalist that kind of comes and goes, no, that he was almost the only one, I think. Or there's another one, another journalist, another American journalist, I think, as well. He's basically the only one,
Maybe you want to revisit your Donbass experiences, because you, I mean, what journalists ought to do is, first, I think they should report from both sides. They should be objective, and they should seek out things that go against the narrative, because there are always two sides to every story, and most people just go to one place and get their PR from Kiev. I mean, I can't believe they still believe it, or maybe they never did, you know. But what things did you find in Donbass that you'd like to give us a perspective on?
Well, I mean, I was in Kiev when the Russians surrounded it. I went to Kiev and I left after a couple of days because, anyone following my work will know that I am critical of Ukrainian ultranationalists, critical of NATO policy. And it wasn't safe in Kiev. Any journalist there who criticizes Ukraine, NATO policy, it's just not safe there. So then I went to the Donbass side. And I think there's very few Western reporters who've been reporting on that side. And so that's why I stayed so long, because I thought it was important work. And the importance of the work is to make people realize that in Donbass, in the separatist areas, in the Russian-speaking areas, most people support Russia. In the west of Ukraine, most people now hate Russia. Let's be clear about that. In Kharkov, Odessa, a huge pro-Russian population as well. Donbass and other Crimea, of course, people are pro-Russian. People want to be part of Russia. And so therefore, there is a solution, an ethical solution to the end of the conflict. When you realize that the ethical solution is for Ukraine to give up territory, for these areas who don't want to be part of Ukraine anymore, that is the solution. And now Western governments are making the mistake that they think they can defeat Russia. They're just going to take more territory. Kharkiv, Odessa, what's going to be the next mistake? And of course, I'm sure, Pelle, you followed myself and other people's work in Donbass. You'll know that also the Ukrainian ultranationalists shell civilians in Donetsk. Many of the stories that I've covered is that if I was a journalist in Kiev, I would be covering Russian missiles, many of which have killed Ukrainian civilians. But on the other side of the conflict, Ukrainian missiles are killing and often targeting markets, bus stations, Donbass civilians.
It's funny, why do we go for the sanctity of the state borders, which is Zelensky's argument? He's invaded us, he said. He's invaded Ukraine. But Ukraine is not a monolithic country. It's a country where the eastern half wants to belong to another country and are affiliated to that country. So should you go with the state border or the loyalties of the people? And in our sort of soft, dovish world, as it were, I mean, the state border was a sort of Westphalian thing, I guess, in a cold, cynical, aristocratic diplomacy. But now we go with people's sympathies, you know, we're all supposed to be Democrats. But yet, we very few Western journalists talk about the truth about who the Donbass people are and where their loyalties are, and the fact that they've always lived there. They're not invaders or intruders. And then I saw this OSCE, which is this neutral body, which shows the hits. And it showed that just before the Russians invaded, there was an acceleration of attacks from the Ukrainian side. So this is from the OSCE international monitors, showing that the Ukrainians, at the very least, did some kind of provocation that led to this Russian invasion.
Well, that's the argument, and it may or well not be true that the Ukrainians may well have been about to launch an attack on Donbass in early 22. I don't know that there's a case there to be had, which is what you're alluding to, and that may well be true, but ultimately, ultimately, the reason Russia invaded, and you can call it what you want, Russia did send their troops. Technically, it is an invasion. Russians call it a special military operation for a reason. Kiev, not. If you go to Kiev, you have to be showing around to find any damage. Kiev is intact. I've been there during the war. The people in Donbass, most of them call it a liberation operation. So it depends on your accident or geographical birth. An invasion, special military operation, although most of the Russian journalists I've met do call it privately a war. I mean, you get to the front line, it's a war. But ultimately, I put out a tweet the other day saying, ultimately, this is another disastrous US-led war. The only difference is that they messed with a country that had the power to launch an invasion first for strategic advantage. Ultimately, it seems clear that it was Ukraine and NATO's policy to try and take back Donbass. And after Donbass, Crimea. And the world is a chessboard of competing nation states. Russia cannot allow NATO to control Crimea. And that's what this is really about. And the left and anti-war movements, many of them, not you, but many in the left and anti-war movements in Europe never understood that. And because Russia invaded first, or whatever you want to call it, that's how they were seen as the aggressors, many since they are. But ultimately, it was NATO's push and Ukraine's push. Whether they attacked in 22 Ukraine, they were trying to take Donbass back, and they wouldn't have stopped.
I mean, the one who fires the first shot is not necessarily the aggressor, because when war is inevitable, then you have to take the strategic advantage of firing first. So if World War III were to break out, it'd be a race to see who's going to fire their missiles first, but then who's to blame for the war? It could be either side. But the point is, once the war has been settled on, it's so naive to say the first shot. And that's why people spent 100 years trying to work out who started World War I, because both sides were on a hair trigger. And although Germany first went into Belgium, the Allies are about to do the same thing, but we don't hear about that, you know? And the Germans had to do it because they needed to forestall what the French were about to do, and the British, you know?
And that's the question now, what happens? There are many analysts who I have huge respect for saying there's no way World War III is going to break out over this. People are going to be too rational. Then you have people like Viktor Orban, who I have great respect for, saying, no, Europe really is just hell-bent on this war. And you look at World War I, which is such a destructive, I mean, just madness for Europe. It wasn't in our self-interest. It wasn't anybody's self-interest. And you think, how did that happen? And so I'm now still torn about whether people will have sense enough to bring this to an end in the next 18 months, or whether Europeans have just gone crazy and they just want to. But it's difficult to see the next move. But some analysts are very rational. You, Pelle, I think are very rational. We can't discount the pure irrationality of some of our decision makers.
No, I know. I think Orban, as I said, you're our fly on the wall, as it were, and he goes to these European. Interestingly, in World War One, the Hungarians were the peaceniks. They pulled the Austrians back from the brink and didn't succeed, but because they were part of Austria-Hungary, but. But, you know, Orban says, you know, they're really talking about, they really aren't going mad. They think, and of course, it's a generation of politicians who know war through video games, perhaps, and they're seeking meaning and they only know each other. I mean, they're an absolutely discreditable bunch. I know those very meeting rooms in the European Parliament, in the Council of Europe, and they go from one to the other and they talk in hushed tones and they're waving their arms about. They're like, it's like a lunatic asylum because they're cut off from the world, then, and they have just friendly court journalists repeating what they say. We have a really, really bad political class, I think. Really bad.
I don't know what I'm telling you. I mean, I see the NATO people cheering, and of course, the American congressmen on the Hill waving their flags and cheering. I was writing a piece last night, which I'll broadcast in some form very soon, or write, and I broke down in tears when I'm writing about war, really. I mean, what you see in Donbass, I've covered Syria, Libya, all the rest of it. When I write about war, I break down in tears. I don't mind admitting it. What you see there, you're absolutely right. These people, and most people watching this, I'm sure don't have much experience of, but probably most people watching this have an understanding. These people have no understanding what war is. Hundreds of thousands of European people are being slaughtered. And it's amazing. People care about Gaza quite rightly. And the targeting of children there. That's not happening in Russia and Ukraine. They're not targeting children. Really, Ukraine, well, I've seen a few schools bombed in Donbass, but they're not purposefully targeted. What's happening in Gaza is horrendous. But hundreds of thousands of people are dying in Ukraine, and no one seems to care about that. And it's incredible, and it's damaging our interests. It's incredible.
Do you want to talk? I don't know. I hesitate to break this subject, but I looked at some of the comments. Who are, you know, I don't usually do that, but somebody called
never
you.
Never look at the comments.
Yeah, good idea. But I've never heard this word before. They called you a Vatnik. And then I looked at his profile and he has this dog. And I've heard of this NAFO movement and they seem absolutely insane. What adult man would put a little dog symbol on his profile and spend his entire life chasing people like you and attacking you with pro-Russian?
First experience I had in NAFO, if anybody watching this doesn't know, is an online troll organization. Most likely, people think that it's started by think tanks and maybe intelligence organizations. It's a huge, huge organization of just sad men, mostly men, who just send abuse. But the first experience I had was an associate member of RUSI, the Royal United Services Institute, the British think tank, one of the most prestigious British think tanks.
That's right.
Associate member of that, I wrote a tweet about Ukraine, and he said, NAFO, go for him. So this online organization, which is set up to attack anybody who criticizes NATO policy. And it does work. There's an alternative journalist, there's a whole way to attack them and to silence them. It starts with the online trolls. You get hit pieces, hacking, death threats. Julian Assange, of course, if you get as big as him, that's what will happen to you, but in jail. There's this whole network ways to silence critics. And online trolling is one of them.
Well, I guess when you're over the target, you get flack or something. I don't think I've had any NAFO attacks yet, but that's because I haven't broken as much new ground as you have. And I just wonder where they get if there's a meme factory where they go and get their... I'm baffled. I'm not that curious about them but I just think it's a kind of illness because the pro Russians, as you say, they don't have a pro. There's no pro Russian NAFO. It's an anti.
Part of an organization to silence critics. Yeah.
Yeah.
Social media abuse is very serious. I mean, most people stop. I mean, you get all this abuse. I got hundreds of death threats from people. Today,
really?
A big account of 70,000 people on X, who openly says he works for the CIA, says, "Watch your back, Johnny. Watch your back in Moscow." He writes me that, "Watch your back." And I get that all the time, "Watch your back, Johnny." Mm. All this stuff, like after Russell.
So it's Bentley, like under the guise of friendly advice,
it's open friend. But then there's also the more just outright, "I hope you die," all this stuff. And social media, but you know, sports people get it, celebrities get it, teenage girls get it. Social media is a you know, horrible place, to be honest. But for journalists who question the mainstream, then you have a particular, you know, they go for you. They go for you for any way they can, yeah.
So, I mean, like TNT's watchword is freedom and anti-censorship, and we have a lot of anti-censorship voices, and we push that. But in a way, you're sort of making a case for censorship. I mean, and I understand you.
No.
Would you?
No, no. I mean, what can you do? I mean, you know, so listen, sports people get it. I'm a big sports fan, okay? You miss a penalty in a big game. People get death at sports people. Mm. Referees, Jesus.
Yeah,
the referees. So you know, the social media—it's just a whole story by itself. No matter who you are, I care for teenage people getting social media. But yeah, when you're a journalist who takes on powerful, but I'm sure BBC journalists get a lot of abuse as well. So that's just one element of it.
But Johnny, we've got a minute left, so we've got to wind up. So I'll just ask you one question, if you can summarize in a minute. Do you follow Russian social media and Russian media in general? And do you find, are they just a mirror image of the Western social media with insults and death threats? Or is it a different tone? You've got about a minute.
I don't know. There's lots of bad Russian people, I'm sure. But it's not so death threats and all the rest of it. Russian people are more skeptical of the media. That's historical. Russian people don't trust their media. It's not to say they don't, you know, Putin at the government is very popular. They generally support the special military operation. But I think maybe because of historical living under communism or whatever, the Russian people are just skeptical people. If you want to talk about COVID, for example, much fewer Russian people got the COVID jab. Everyone I speak to here says, no, I wouldn't do that. Russian people are generally more skeptical. But the media, listen, Russian media puts its point of view as well.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, we know our media. Well, anyway, well, thank you. That's very refreshing. You can find Johnny Miller on his, just type that into X and Twitter. And we wish you very, very best of luck in your broadcasts about wars. And we'd love to have you on again quite soon. So this is the Pelinero's Taylor Show on a Tuesday afternoon. And we're going to have our second hour guest coming up after the news break and then my analysis. Thanks, Johnny. Good luck. That was good. Thanks.